So we're talking about discovering the grace of God in the Old Testament. You know, when we talk about grace or discovering grace, I would think that the old, and I would think that this is the majority of people, that the worst place in the world you can discover grace is in the Old Testament. It's got a bad rap because people really don't understand it. They look at the law, the Mosaic law, all the different rules. You know, you had the Mosaic law. You got 10 basic commandments. And when the Jewish tradition, and this is from the Talmud itself, they counted 613 separate commandments, 613. One of the problems of legalism and versus grace, legalism never ends. It really never ends. You go down that rabbit hole. Listen to this, though. This is in Exodus chapter 23, verse 19. Maybe you read this before. It says, don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Okay? Have you guys ever heard that expression before? Okay. So that's in Exodus 23. This one is kind of famous because it eventually led to the whole Jewish separation of meat and dairy. Do you guys know that cheeseburgers are not kosher? I was kind of sad about that. I like cheeseburgers. So this one is famous because eventually it led to the whole mindset of Jewish, more orthodoxy, separating meat and dairy. Because of this Jewish tradition, meat and dairy can't be eaten together. That's what it basically comes down to. Now, it doesn't say that in the Bible. It says just don't boil a goat in its mother's milk. There's different reasons for that. But it goes a little further. The original command I just mentioned, over the centuries, Jewish teachers reasoned, well, if you can't cook meat and milk together, then you shouldn't eat them together either. You see how it's going? It's progressing down the line. And that's how legalism is. And you shouldn't even benefit from the mixture of meat and milk. So meat and dairy should be kept separate. Okay, this is the reasoning that's happened over the centuries. So it goes even further, though. Separation expanded through the years to avoid accidental mixing. The Jewish traditions, they added all these protective boundaries. Separate dishes, if you're preparing cheese in one and meat on another, you can't serve them on the same platter. Separate cookware, separate sinks, separate prep areas. Eventually, and I know this for a fact because I have a good friend, separate refrigerators. Jewish people that followed this reasoning, they separate refrigerators. Why separate refrigerators? Well, because meat juice can drip onto the cheese or whatever. You know, they go down this road. Containers can leak, and people might accidentally store or prepare items together. In a strict Jewish kosher home, you'll see two fridges, refrigerators. You'll see one fridge, you'll have very strict separation in that area. See, now it can't even be near each other. You see where it's going, though? It started off with a simple command that, first of all, they looked at it the wrong way. They were not looking at what God was saying there. I know some Jewish households, they color code their shelves, their containers. It's all about preventing accidental mixing. That's what it's about. Or how about work on the Sabbath? I thought this was kind of funny. On the Sabbath, traditional Jewish law prohibits turning electrical devices on or turning them off. You can't. That's work. Okay, that's work. So the question becomes, can someone turn on or turn off a light switch or a TV or anything like that before the Sabbath? According to Jewish sources, the answer is yes, as long as the human action happens before the Sabbath begins. So if you had a light on, you could leave it on. You just can't turn it off, right? You got maybe the TV's running 24/7. I don't know. So timers, Jewish households put timers on their, and some of us have timers, but they go on during the Sabbath and they go off at a certain time. A timer is set before the Sabbath. You couldn't set it on the Sabbath because that's considered work. But once the Sabbath begins, the timer turns the light on or off automatically. The person does nothing, so he's not really doing work. No switch is flipped. Or let's get a little bit more extreme, because it does go down that hole. That's what legalism does. It takes something, and it gets worse and worse and worse. Now, here's a more extreme one. Using Gentiles to do work on the Sabbath. That happens. It happens. But there's even rules to that. There's a concept known in Jewish law as telling the non-Jew to do something on the Sabbath. But the core rule is that a Jew may not, a Jew is forbidden to do work on the Sabbath, but a Jew could not tell a Gentile to do work on the Sabbath either. Got that? So there's this core rule. So the basic rule, you can't outsource Sabbath breaking. That's what it comes down to. This goes from the time before, well, the Talmud, and then it went into the centuries and the millennium up until modern day. So you can't outsource Sabbath breaking. But there's a fine distinction. There's always something to get around, right? There's a fine distinction. And here's where it gets very interesting. The rabbis distinguish between direct instructions and, you know, turn on that light for me, right? To a Gentile, that's prohibited because you're telling somebody to do work on the Sabbath. That's not allowed. But the indirect benefit, a Gentile does not do something on their own, and a Jew benefits from it. That's what it is. They can do something on their own. And so sometimes allowed depending on the situation. And here's where it gets creative. The hinting principle, right? You can't say, turn on the light switch. But you can say, you know, it's very dark in here. That sounds like, well, let's just say it sounds like marriage sometimes. You guys hint a lot. We know the code already. We know all about the code. We know what it means. Sometimes I'll have to tell my wife, can't you just ask me? You don't have to tell me, but yeah, we know the code. So if the Gentile chooses to turn on the lights, it didn't break the Sabbath. So this becomes a whole category of Sabbath practice. But you can see, you're really trying to get around the heart of what you're even saying. You don't want to do work on the Sabbath or whatever. So the example, you can hire a Gentile to stoke a fire before the Sabbath, and they could come at their own schedule. And they did a lot of this, you know, as technology grew, you know, heating homes, lighting lamps, carrying items, operating machinery. It's all down through the centuries. But that's, you get the drift of legalism. Where's God in any of it, first of all? I mean, God said, and Jesus said, I made the Sabbath so you could rest. That's what it was. I made the Sabbath for man. That's what it was. So, but you need to know the Mosaic law is not the rule, because we're going to go back in time before the Mosaic law even started, and we're going to go back to the time of grace of Abraham. Grace was demonstrated to us in Genesis before the Mosaic law ever came into effect. There's other reasons for the Mosaic law. One is to show that we're sinful creatures. I can't obey all 613 commands or even the Ten Commandments. I've broken those. So you need to know the Mosaic law is not the rule of thumb by God. Grace is. And grace is demonstrated before the Mosaic Law is even appearing in the Bible. So this morning, I want to give you a few examples from the Old Testament of grace. And some of them we mentioned last week. Then we're going to get into our text in Genesis and Abraham. So our title today is, you know, God's grace in the Old Testament, or discovering grace in the Old Testament. And we're going to look at the Old Testament examples. We're going to look at the promise of grace we'll see in Abraham. And then we'll see the confirming grace to Abraham. It's really important to understand that. So let's look at the Old Testament examples. Adam and Eve, one of the first, after their rebellion, they sinned, they hid, they blamed each other. God still clothed them. Okay, these are simple things. Promised a redeemer right away and allowed their life to continue. You know, he did say, the moment you sin, you shall die. And we know that he meant that spiritually, but he could have taken their life immediate, because whoever sins deserves death. We know that. So Adam and Eve were the first. Noah, we talked about this last week. Noah was grace before obedience. Before he built the ark, God showed him grace. God showed him grace. Obedience always, and this is how it should be, obedience always comes through and after grace is in your life. We obey because we want to. You know, Jesus says, if you love me, obey me. You know, those are kind of simple things. So the world's corrupt. Noah's imperfect, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Then you got Jacob. I always like looking at Jacob as being a really extreme. He was a deceiver. He was a liar. He was kind of a manipulator. Jacob, he lies, he cheats. And God appears to him in a dream to protect him from Esau. He blesses him at Bethel. He changes his name to Israel, which means governed of God. And, you know, his name before Jacob was kind of a sneaky deceiver. That's what his name was, or foot catcher. So you see that even after his whole life and the many things that he went up and down in, deceiving and manipulating, God showed him grace, man. He's one of the patriarchs that we look at as being. So he turned a schemer into a patriarch. That's the grace of God. So Moses, he's a murderer, right? He murdered an Egyptian. And then he turned deliverer. We know that Moses had three lives when you think about it. He had the life with Pharaoh, a life of luxury. Then he murdered somebody. Then he had a life in the wilderness. And then he had a life of delivering Israel out of Egypt and leading them to the promised land. So he kills an Egyptian. He flees into the wilderness. God calls him, fiery bush, equips him, sends him to use him as a deliverer. You know, grace transforms failure into leadership. And then you have Rahab. You guys know who Rahab is? She was a prostitute in the city of Jericho. That's Joshua 2, the second chapter. She's a Gentile. She's a prostitute. She's living in a doomed city. Yet God saves her, includes her in Israel. And, you know, she's in the lineage of Jesus Christ. She's part of that lineage from Adam to Mary, part of that lineage. She's in there. So the grace of God there. Ruth. Ruth is a Moabite widow in the book of Ruth. You know, the Moabites were excluded from Israel's assembly. She's poor. She's foreign. She's widowed. God provides for her, redeems her through Boaz, replaces her in also in the Messianic line. She's David's grandmother. Or is it great-grandmother? Grandmother? I think it's grandmother. So grace adopts the stranger. And then we have David. Grace after a moral collapse, when you think about it. I mean, he caved in. He was in sin for over a year. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12. He commits adultery, deception, then he murders somebody by putting him in the front line of the war. Yet God, he confronts him. Remember, the prophet confronted him. And then he forgives him. He restores him and continues his covenant with him. And now, sin has its consequences. We know that. But the grace of God, by the legal law of Moses, David should have been stoned. He should have been stoned. Murder and adultery. He should have been stoned. God forgave him and gave him grace. Grace doesn't erase the consequences. It doesn't, okay? But it restores the relationship. And I think that that's important to understand. And then you got, I think, Jim's favorite, Jonah, right? Jonah. Grace to a rebellious prophet and to a wicked city. You get a twofer in there, you know? Grace on Nineveh and grace on Jonah. So Jonah runs from God. God pursues him. Grace does pursue us. And that's important to remember. Pursues him. He rescues him from the, well, first from the boat and then from the fish. And then he recommissions him. That's important to remember. And then God shows grace to Nineveh, a very wicked city, that they believed that Jonah was telling the truth and they repented. So grace reaches both down to the stubborn prophet, to an undeserving nation. You know, right now, it is only the grace of God that's sustained in America. It's only the grace of God. You know, we claim to be this great nation, and we are, you know, there's a lot of good things about our nation that I don't want to live anywhere else. But the truth is that America deserves great judgment, great judgment. It's been those that are given much require much, and America is going to be required in the judgment of that great white throne judgment. Now, you guys notice I left one out, and I think that we need to be able to look at this person in more detail, and that's where we begin in chapter 12, this promise grace, the promise grace. If there's any example in the Old Testament that I think deserves the discovery of grace, it's our father of faith, Abraham. I've been thinking about this story a lot this week and how that... Now, Abraham's story begins in darkness, not devotion. He was not a good guy in the beginning. He was serving idols. So, and I'll show you in Joshua where it says that. Well, at least his family was. We don't know where his heart was at. But Genesis 11 and 12, before Abraham ever hears God's voice, the Bible gives us a surprising detail that he comes from Ur of the Chaldees, a center of idol worship. And his family served other gods. Listen to this in Joshua chapter 24. Joshua said to all the people, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah," that is the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, "dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods." They served other gods. We don't know where Abraham was at in all of this. We know that there's a short lineage between Adam and Noah, and then there's even a shorter period of time between Noah and Abraham. So, but people were serving other gods. Terah was in that lineage going up to from Abraham or from Adam to, you know, being the father of Abraham. So you got to think, and I thought about this week a lot about Abraham. He has no spiritual remedy or resume, right? He has no spiritual resume. I mean, you don't see anything before this. There's no covenant. There's no obedience. There's no righteousness. In other words, Abraham's story begins with grace because God calls a man, and this pertains to all of us, who isn't looking for him. It doesn't seem like Abraham was, or he was looking for anything. He was going about his business. Genesis 12 opens up with God speaking. not Abraham speaking. He says, now the Lord, now we're in verse 1 of chapter 12. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those that bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and all the families of the earth, and in all the families of the earth, you shall be blessed. When God calls Abraham, he doesn't give him a burden. There's nothing there. There's nothing, you got to obey me, you got to do this. He's just a calling on his life. He gives him a sevenfold promise without ever requiring one thing from Abraham. He says, I will make you a great nation. Now, part of that, we look at the highlight of Israel, David and Solomon's time, pretty powerful nation in the area. This is a promise, though, about a great nation called Israel with the reign of Jesus Christ. That's eventually going to happen. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will bless you. That's the second thing. I will make your name great. That, when you think about the monotheistic religions, you got, you know, Islam, you got Judaism, you got Christian. Abraham is the king, man. He's the king. He's recognized in all three, and he's recognized as, in our case, the father of faith. And then it says, you will be a blessing. You will be a blessing. And then he says, I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those that curse you. God protected, he protected Abraham. He's protecting Israel to this day because of this promise. And then he says, all the families of the earth will be blessed through you. We know that's the lineage all the way down to Jesus Christ. All the families of the earth. He's not just talking about the Jewish. He says, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed because of this relationship I've called you into. Now, notice the pattern. God says, I will, again and again, before Abraham does nothing. He does nothing. We don't know anything before that. We know that his whole family was involved in idol worship. So God's grace always starts with God's initiative. It doesn't start with you. And you think about this. Where were you at when God called you? I was not thinking about God. I was having a pretty good time. I was having a pretty good time. My sin had not yet caught up with me yet. But in the middle of all my sin that I was enjoying during that period of time, all of a sudden God popped into my life. I don't know about you guys, but that's exactly how he works. I wasn't seeking the Lord. I wasn't looking for him. I thought about him. You know, you ponder, you think about God. But I wasn't thinking about that. And all of a sudden, and I have to say, in the height of my sinfulness, where I was actually enjoying my sinfulness, that's when God called me. It wasn't like I was on the, yeah, I think I should repent, and all of a sudden God appeared. It wasn't like that at all. I don't know about you guys. You're floating along. All of a sudden, you're kind of satisfied with your life. You're doing this. You're doing that. Maybe you got a great job, a great house, you know, good marriage, all this. And then all of a sudden, God comes into your life. So grace always starts with God's initiative. It's his initiative that you're sitting here today. It's his initiative. So the initiative, I mean, it's entirely God. And this is the first major grace point that we see in Abraham's life. Grace starts the relationship, not Abraham. He didn't start the relationship. Abraham's story doesn't begin with a man searching for God. He's not searching for God. Begins with the man living in a world of idols. You know, he had to be called out of that. He would have stayed in it. His family served the gods of that culture, a very wicked city during that time. They had all kinds of things going on. They had, you guys know what a ziggurat is? It's kind of a pyramid with, on top they would have these worship times where the priests and a lot of sick idolatry would go on in those places. So he lived in a city that was very wicked. And they, you know, they're in that city, carved images, they offered sacrifices, they followed the whole mode of that city. And no different than us. We were just following the heir of the nation, right? I mean, if you were in the 70s, you partied a lot. And, you know, you rebelled a lot and different things like that. You guys got your 80s and your 90s people in here and maybe beyond that, but you just follow the heir of Satan, really, when you think about it. So Abraham was not a priest. He wasn't a seeker, not a righteous hero. It's interesting. I looked into what the Jews thought of Abraham, okay? They hold Abraham very high. I hold Abraham very high. I look at his example of, his calling and all that. I resemble that calling. That's what it is. But the Jews, they look at Abraham as a very legalistic thing, that he was this special guy, and because he was so special, God picked him. And that's not the case at all. It's not the case. So Abraham wasn't religious, it doesn't seem. He was simply another man in a land where no one knew the living God. That's all he was. He was just like me and you, no different. But then without warning, what happened? God spoke. He spoke first. There's no buildup, there's no explanation, no reason given, just a voice into an ordinary life, go to a land that I'm going to show you. That's the grace of God. That's the grace of God. He didn't earn that moment, if you think he did. He didn't pray for it. He didn't qualify for it. If God did not call Abraham, we would never know about this guy. He probably would have been just sucked into the city where he was at, and he would have went to the grave like all of us are gonna. That's where he's at. He didn't earn the moment. He didn't pray for it. He didn't qualify for it. God, you know, grace always begins this way, with God stepping toward someone who isn't stepping toward him. And with this call comes a promise, not a demand. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. And those seven I wills that God spoke toward him. You know, before Abraham takes a single step, God is already promising the future. You know, grace always speaks in I will, not you must. It doesn't speak that way. That's the way it is in the Bible before. So get it out of your mind that grace is something that you must accomplish in your life. Get that out of your mind. Abraham obeys. But we know he doesn't obey perfectly, right? Grace always gives us the ability to obey. I mean, that's what it is. We wanna, who here doesn't wanna obey God perfectly? I would love that, but let's face it, he did not obey perfectly. We know he's had some little glitches in his life. He leaves the homeland, but he's supposed to separate himself from his family. Who does he bring? He brings Lot. And that causes problems later on. And yet, through every misstep, God stays with him. God protects him in Egypt. God brings them back into the land. God renews his promises over and over again. God keeps blessing them. Abraham's failures does not cancel out God's call. That's the grace of God. That's grace. That's grace itself. So that's the promised grace that we see toward Abraham. But there's a confirming grace also. And in chapter 12, you get the promise of grace. And then chapter 15, you have the confirming grace. It's a night in Genesis chapter 15. And it, you know what? It's a turning point in Abraham's life. I love the fact that the grace of God gives us these little turning points in our life. He reaffirms over and over and over again. He chases us down. He equips us. He does all these things for us. And he's got these appointments ahead of time for all of us to reaffirm that grace toward us. That's important to understand. So Abraham's a little older now. The promise of some of the things, you know, I got to have a son to be able to have a great nation and all these, there's some prerequisites. The promise feels impossible at this point. And it starts off with Genesis 15:1. It says, after these things, he's a little older, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield and your exceedingly great reward. Those are those continuation of grace in our own lives. But Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing that I go childless? The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. Then Abram said, look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my own house is my heir. And that's what would happen then, is that you would have the head of the household would inherit all things outside of the lineage. So, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him saying, this one shall not be the heir, but the one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. Then he brought him outside. I always love this. He says, look now toward the heavens and count the stars, if you're able to number them. And he said, so shall your descendants be. And he believed in the Lord, and he accounted to him for righteousness. That's faith in him, trusting in him, gives us the righteousness of God. And we know that the finality of that is Jesus Christ. He gave us the righteousness of God. He looks up at the stars and he says, count them. You know, Jeff was talking about the southern, you know, you go down to Florida, some of the times we've gone down there to the island where it's really dark and they have the turtle rules. You guys know what that is? Where you can't have lights on because the turtles are laying the eggs and all that. I mean, I'm talking about stars. You know, we're in a different universe than Chicago. Chicago, if you see a couple, sometimes you look at it and, oh, that's an airplane, you know, and that's what it is. It's nothing. But he says, look up at the stars, count. That is going to be your offspring. And something happens inside Abraham, not perfection, certainly, but trust. He trusts in the Lord. The hardest thing about grace to me is to believe that it's true, right? The fullness of the grace of God. Can you believe that? Sometimes it's hard. But something happens inside Abraham, and it wasn't perfection. It was trust. He believed God, and at that moment, God counts him righteous. Not because Abraham earned it, and not because he was flawless. He was a broken man just like us. But because grace gives that work that works can never do. It gives us what works could never do in our lives. That's what grace is. So he's got the question, right? How How are you going to prove this to me? And Abraham says, Lord God, how shall I know that I will inherit it? And he says, bring me a three-year-old heifer, three-year-old female goat, three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. By the way, I was looking at that, and you realize that those are all clean animals before there was anything about unclean or clean. And those were all some of the primary sacrifices to be used later on in, and even by the year, the three-year-old and all that. So it's interesting that Abraham, something, you know, when God brings this all about. So he says, bring me a three-year-old heifer, three-year-old female goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Then he brought all of these to him, and they cut them in two, and down the middle, and placed each opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds in two. So you take a heifer, a ram, whatever, and they slice them, they put them there, put them there, put them there, put them there. And it says, and the vultures came down and the carcasses, on the carcasses, Abraham drove them away. So he's awake at this point. Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, horror and a great darkness fell upon him. Now, that deep sleep, that word, is the same word they use for Adam. So my assumption here is that God put him to sleep. God put him to sleep. Same word as Adam, when he put Adam to sleep to take the rib out and create Eve. Then he said to Abraham, know certainly, now this is in his dream, that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. They will serve them and will afflict them 400 years. That's when Moses is going to appear on the spot. And the nation whom they serve, I will judge. That would be Egypt. Afterwards, they shall come out with great possessions. Now, for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. So gives the whole history of not only Israel to be, but even Abraham. But in the fourth generation, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And it came to pass when the sun went down, it was dark, that behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between the pieces. On the same day, the Lord God made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, Abraham starts asking God how he can be sure of the promise. God answers by commanding Abraham to prepare what they call a covenant or a contract sacrifice. This would answer Abraham's question. God tells him to do this. Now, this was a very common, this is common. They've got like tablets of the Hittites. They show this very thing in there. So it was a common contract. I remember the last time we had a contract with for our house, we got our house redone for, reorganized or refinanced. And it was a stack of papers like that, you know? And you had to sign every one of them. And after a while, I just start scribbling, you know, but that's how you would secure the contract. You would walk down the middle of these pieces to secure the contract. So the problem is Abraham falls asleep. He falls asleep. This contract would be used back then as, like, say you were going to buy a piece of land or a building or something like that. You would do this. You would act, this would be a formal contract in those days. But the problem is Abraham goes to sleep. He's to be the other half of this contract. They would walk together. So this smoking fire and this flaming torch and symbols of God's presence. That's what it is. Symbols of God's presence. Pass between the animals. And by doing this, God alone, listen to this, he seals the covenant, bringing himself or binding himself to the promise. He himself, I swear to myself, that's what he's saying here, that I will do this, I will do this. So God takes the consequences of covenant breaking on himself, which he never breaks a promise. He never breaks a promise. The consequences in those days, and this is written, I think it's written in Jeremiah and somewhere else, that if you broke a contract like this, let you be as the dead animals that are you're walking between if you break it. But God doesn't break a promise. He doesn't tell lies. Only God walks through it. Abraham does not. This is the heart of grace. It's the heart of grace. So next week we're going to be talking about grace in the New Testament. A lot easier to understand, but this is pretty heavy to me, how the grace of God came into Abraham's life. We looked at grace of God in the Old Testament, those people of grace, David, Ruth, you know, Rahab, all of that. And it continues on. I could have probably made a 20 or 30 people list. It continues on and on. So the grace of God in the Old Testament, then the promise grace, God's unconditional promise to Abraham before he did anything. It was his calling. And then finally, the confirming, how God confirms the promise to Abraham by walking through that covenant sacrifice by himself. You know, God found us long before we were looking for him. And that is the truth. He called us out of our lives. I don't know what you were doing. Maybe you were building your own life. And he invited us in a different way, a better way, into his covenant of grace that he would take care of us. You know, we stepped into a very imperfect faith. I don't have perfect faith. If you think that you're going to have to maintain that faith, you don't understand the grace of God. We have imperfect faith, and into a life that's so different. And just exactly like he called Abraham, he called each one of us. You know, we're stumbling, we're doubting along the way, but what? God is holding to us. He's holding on. And then we discovered what Abraham learned under the stars, that God himself carries the weight of the promise. He carries the weight of the promise. He makes us his, not because we're strong, but because he's gracious. That's all. I don't know anybody in here. If you call yourself strong, you're probably, you're deceived. we're not strong. We're not strong. We all know where we stumble. So this is our whole story. It's just wrapped up. Just one last thought is we are called by grace. We are kept by grace. We are made right with God by trusting him who came to us first. You guys understand that? I mean, I can't think of a better way to explain it out of the Old Testament as using Abraham. It's a perfect example. And there's many more you can discover in that. So, you guys want to stand?